This is Julie Pearson, Little Thunder, and today is Monday, November 20th, 2017. I'm interviewing Nathan Young for the Oklahoma Native Artists Project, sponsored by the Oklahoma Oral History Research Program at Oklahoma State University. We're at the studio provided to Nathan by the Tulsa Artist Fellowship in downtown Tulsa. Nathan, you're Delaware, Pawnee, and Kiowa. You work and teach in a variety of media, including installation, sound and music, composition, performance, film, and video. You've done a number of projects with the group Post Commodity, and your art has traveled to many places around the world. But as you mentioned in the panel last week, one reason you're so happy to have this fellowship is that it gives you a platform to work and exhibit here in Oklahoma. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today. Where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in Hastings Hospital in Tahlequah, Oklahoma in 1975. I grew up in Tahlequah, Oklahoma my entire adolescence, childhood, until I went to college and moved to Stillwater and then Norman, Oklahoma.
Okay. What did your mom and dad do for a living?
My mother was an educator at Northeastern State University. She retired as the director of the Center for Tribal Studies. She was the chairperson of the Indian Symposium for 30 years, most of her tenure there. My father was an attorney specializing in Indian law. And so he was one reason why we lived in Tahlequah is because he worked closely with Ross Swimmer, Bill Keeler, and kind of some of the Ralph Keene, some of the kind of the people who were reorganizing the Cherokee Nation at the time. And my father, the Youngs, were originally Delaware. I'm Delaware on my father's side. We're from the Delaware Tribe of Indians in the eastern part of Oklahoma. I'm a tribal council member at this moment. I was elected last year. We're Delaware Tribe of Indians. We're from Manhattan in the Delaware River Valley. And my mother is Pawnee and Kiowa from Pawnee, Oklahoma.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have two sisters. My brother is a attorney at the Cherokee Nation. He's an expert in Indian law, federal Indian law policy as well. He followed in my father's footsteps.
Uh-huh. How about your relationship with your grandparents on either side?
I was quite close with my grandmother on my mother's side. Her name was Bernice Chapman. She was a Kiowa and Pawnee. She was born in Carnegie, Oklahoma, and then was raised in Pawnee, or grew up part of her life in Pawnee because her mom was Pawnee. Her dad was Kiowa. His name was Gilbert Colley. Her name was Anna Walker. I was really close to my grandma. My brother and I were a handful when we were young, and my parents were also very busy doing their work. So my grandmother moved down to Tahlequah to help raise us. And so I spent a lot of time with my grandma Chapman, Lucille Bernice Chapman I spent a lot of time with her. She had a huge influence on my life. My grandpa Chapman, who when I was born was the president of the Pawnee Business Council, passed away when I was in college. On the Young side, the Youngs also moved to Tahlequah to keep an eye on us kids. But my grandfather was the treasurer of the Delaware Tribe of Indians for 20 years. My aunt was on the Tribal Council of the Delaware Tribe of Indians. My father is on the council as well, and now he's a judge for the tribe. But my grandfather was a executive at Phillips Petroleum and was very close with Bill Keeler, who was the first elected modern chief of the Cherokee Nation. And so the Delaware Tribe of Indians and the Cherokee Nation have a very complicated relationship. We share no cultural ties. They're purely legal. However, my grandfather and Bill Keeler were close. My aunt Wathine was on the Cherokee Tribal Council. My father worked government-to-government relations for Ross Swimmer, so I grew up around Ross Swimmer and Will Man Killer. I grew up in their homes. I remember going to parties at their houses and stuff, and so I was very fortunate. And I'm very blessed with to be able to be raised in Tahlequah by my parents, and my mother being the chairperson of the Indian Symposium at Northeastern State for so long. I was able to meet a lot of authors, artists, be around a lot of very, 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 very interesting and very important tribal American Indian intellectuals and leaders, spiritual leaders, and things like that. So Tahlequah is a big, not just a mixing pot of Indians and non-Indians, but just intertribal. So you'll meet more Kiowa Cherokees there. I'm surprised. I meet more Kiowa Cherokees than I'm shocked, you know. But at one time I heard there were more Pawnees living in Tahlequah than there were in Pawnee. I probably shouldn't say that, but I mean, I think that's it was just a pure it happened. But yeah, it was a really great growing up there, and I think I'm a reflection of that.
Really rich background. What are your earliest memories of seeing Native art?
I don't really remember seeing Native art. Native art was in my home all the time. And I grew up, my mother's uncle, who passed away just last week, Charles Chapman, was a really well-known painter. Because of my parents' work or their just who they, I don't know, they had a lot of his paintings. They had on my grandmother, my grandma Chapman, Lucille, her uncle was Charlie Rowell, who painted in a Native American church, peyote art style. He painted in a flat, what they call a studio style, that came out of the Kiowa Five. You know, whereas Charlie was like a Western art, but I grew up the images in on my parents' walls were by peyote paintings by Mars Big Goose, Charlie Rowell paintings by Charlie Chapman, names like Doito, David Williams lived in Tahlequah. All of these guys from the 70s, I remember. Copying tiger paintings when I was in, we had Indian art in my junior high class, taught by a very accomplished Indian artist. It's a very, very interesting place, Tahlequah. Those are my first memories of it, is just seeing it in my home.
Who is the artist?
Mr. Daniels. He's a potter. He's a ceramicist. I'm blanking on his first name right now.
Mike
Daniels. Yeah. And another Cherokee artist was my mother's. He's my godfather in the Catholic Church is Harry Ossowee, and he painted in that flat style, the studio flat style, like with gouache and like Charlie Rowell and the Kiowa Five and Harry Ossowee and Mary Ossowee, they were also very important people in my, kind of upbringing. They were my parents' best friends, and so I grew up with Harry Ossowee's paintings on my parents' walls and things like that. Still hang up on in their house today.
Neat. What are your earliest memories of making art?
Well. My earliest memories of making art are when my grandpa Chapman drew a tattoo of an eagle on my arm for me. He was in the Marine Corps. He fought at Iwo Jima. Had a Purple Heart from that battle, and he had a Marine Corps tattoo. And I wanted to copy his Marine Corps tattoo when I was a little bitty kid. So I was not even in kindergarten yet, and he showed me how to the basics to draw a bunny on a hill, and he showed me how to draw a wing and an eagle. And I couldn't draw the eagle, but I remember, and it stayed with me, and later on I could. Other than that, I could always draw. It was just a kind of a natural, it was a natural talent I had for copying things. And so, but I was, so that's the first art I remember ever making. And then in junior high, I started to copy album covers from heavy metal and punk, and even classic rock album covers like the Grateful Dead, Skulls, and things like that. I would obsessively try to kind of make a facsimile of them, and got pretty good at it, and still have a collection of those.
So you were exposed to art classes throughout the Tahlequah public school system.
Yeah, well, I wasn't. I only in junior high.
Okay.
Mike Daniels only teaches in junior. He only taught at the junior high. In high school, I was primarily interested in literature, and I was just a voracious reader. And it was just your typical kind of young, rebellious kid stuff, learning about the Beats, Charles Bukowski, Burroughs, Kerponica, things like that. I really didn't read what they were teaching in school, in my classes, but it was such a small place at that time that I still was really teacher supported my interest in those things. But I did not take any art classes in high school at whatsoever. I couldn't even tell you who taught art. I don't even know if they had it, honestly.
Well, how did you end up at the University of Oklahoma for college, and what was your major?
Well, I started my long undergraduate career at Oklahoma State University.
Okay.
And I was a history major. I was just interested in history, and however the workload was very, very, you know, intense, and I was starting to develop an interest in art, more of a serious interest in art. Mm-hmm. Things were kind of changing then. It was the mid to late 90s. There was kind of identity art, multiculturalism was becoming a thing. I was starting to notice different forms at that time, and today, OSU's art facilities, it's a different story than it was in 1996, 97. So I decided to transfer to the University of Oklahoma, and that's where I met Dr. Mary Jo Watson, who made had a major influence on my life and my work, as well as Edgar Heap of Birds. And not only those study, I decided I wanted to leave history and study art history. Mm-hmm. And I did not know who Mary Jo Watson was, and I met her and learned some things, and just became, you know, had my eyes opened by her and Edgar. That's where Cade Twist and I met. We were both studying in all of those fields, but particularly the native languages at University of Oklahoma. So I had an interest in the chair. I took all of the native language courses available except for Kiowa. And it was just because I wasn't the best student. And so the class would fill up. So I never got to study with Gus Palmer. But I studied Cherokee with Bobby Joe Blossom. Continued. I have an interest today, even still. I work for the Cherokees television show called OCO TV, and my niece is in the Cherokee language immersion, and that led me on even more. But I guess what I'm trying to get to is that at the same time where I was learning about native languages, and my mother was involved and what was called ONLA, the Oklahoma Native Languages Association, with the Dr. Ikira Yamamoto. I knew them. I was going to their conferences while I was also studying Cherokee. My mother's impetus for working with them was she grew up around her grandma Annie, hearing Pawnee, and it disappeared there for a little while, or it became endangered, and or dormant, and so she wanted to. She was a part of Omaha. She's not a native speaker. Neither am I. Nobody in my family is. As I started to learn how languages work, I was also learning from Edgar Heap-of-Birds the language of contemporary art, and learning from Mary Jo Watson's the problematics of art history, the canon of art history, anthropology, ethnology, and things like that. And again, that's kind of what led to the birth of Postcommodity, was working with, or just really learning from Edgar, and also those Cherokee language classes, thinking about how the language of arts, how symbols work, and how people think about things and describe things and create, you know, how symbols have meaning and how that changes dependent upon your worldview.
So are you saying that did Postcommodity sort of start with you and Cade at University of Oklahoma? Or
neither. Like, both Cade and I were both too sensible to think that we could make a career in art. And we were probably right, you know. We were not able to start to pursue any types of, I moved back after college. Mm-hmm. Cade, three of us started Postcommodity. It was Stephen Yazzie, me, and Cade Twist. After college, Cade moved to Washington, D.C. and worked for a think tank. I moved to Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, and worked in Indian education. And I met a guy named Joseph Erb, an animator. And I started making, Joseph Erb taught me how to animate and how to edit. And at Fort Gibson, which is a very, very, very excellent public school, they had a Cherokee language teacher named Victor Wildcat. So Tom Stiles, the superintendent, knew that I had this opportunity. Joseph Erb had this vision to help save the Cherokee language. He was an animator he just graduated MFA from Penn. He knew we couldn't do computer animation. He was making computer animations in Cherokee, but he wanted to teach students, and he wanted to make curriculum materials. He worked for my Aunt Wathien at American Indian Resource Center. And so they had a grant where he went around to Dahlonega, all these other Bell, all these other small Cherokee communities, and he would do animations in those special animation projects. Well, I worked for Fort Gibson Public Schools. Mr. Stiles had me do an internship basically with Joseph one summer in Tahlequah. We made a feature film called The Messenger, a feature stop motion animation. I learned how to make stop motion animations. We had Victor Wildcat there. Joseph was around, running around, going to five different schools a week. I worked at Fort Gibson Public Schools with a language speaker, with one of the best cultural teachers in the state, and Victor Wildcat. And so our animations were really nice. We would work with the theater department. We would work with the art department. We worked with classes as young as second grade, which was a challenge, you know, different.
And you'd never done any film work before.
I'd never done any film. It wasn't available. This is, you know, the cameras were becoming cheaper, and you know, Macintosh computer, you know, or Apple computers were opening the door to filmmaking. And so I did that for 3 years at Fort Gibson, and then I got nominated for a fellowship from the Rockefeller Foundation.
So you're nominated by someone else?
I was nominated anonymously.
Okay. And that, was it a surprise?
I just saw it as an opportunity.
Right.
I just saw it as an opportunity. I've always been in I've always played music. I've always cared about art. I've always, you know, traveled to see art. It was my hobby. Not really. It was just, you know, I always cared. My brother, who's an attorney, he still reads art for him. You know.
But you'd been playing music, you say.
I'd been playing music.
Currently, with what instruments?
Well, I mean, I played classical piano for 10 years. Studied with a professor at NSU that taught also, secondary students. Always played the guitar and had an interest in heavy metal, was a skateboarder. But also played sports. Tahlequah, you could do whatever you wanted. There were no rules. It wasn't like a big school where you could be a cowboy and skateboard if you wanted, you know. And so, but I grew up, listening and playing heavy metal and things like that, and always had that kind of spirit. I was just always a little bit too sensible. The reason why I studied art history and my degree is in art history because I knew that I could be an administrator, or I thought that, you know, I can be involved and have a good life and be an administrator. And so I used to say that art kind of chose me, you know, but I don't know if that's really the case. I just landed here. I'm just lucky. I've learned from my peers, you know, that's really it. I learned documentary filmmaking from Dustin Craig. You know, and I learned that because I was teaching animation, and we were teaching a concurrent workshop, and that's also how I met Sterling Harjo and started to collaborate with Sterling. So I'm really fortunate that I've just been right place, right time. I've been able to, you know, be friends, long-term friends, a lot of really talented people, and it's been able to. You know, I've been able to maintain a foot in the filmmaking world, though I'm not producing anymore. For 10 years, I had a production company. But really what happened was, though, I got the Rockefeller Fellowship, and it gave me the ability to spend more time in the Southwest with Cade and Stephen Yazzie to start Post Commodity.
It gave me the... The purpose of the fellowship was to allow you to pursue a particular project?
Yeah, the okay. Rockefeller was to pursue a particular project that I never was able to complete, actually. Mm-hmm. It was a story about Pawnee, the origins of Pawnee medicine. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just not able to complete the film, you know. There were no deliverables. Mm-hmm. While that was my proposal, maybe we should just say that film's still in progress.
But in the interim, then what happened was you got together with Cade and
started to do post. I also wrote a screenplay called Heavy Metal Indians, mm-hmm. about the murder of Donnie Beartrack, a guy that I grew up with and I'm distantly related to through my Kiowa family. That's what I was told by my grandmother. But I grew up in the same peer group skateboarding with him. He was murdered under a bridge not far from Tahlequah. He wrote the tag numbers on his arms. Otherwise, they would have gotten away with it. But I was a skateboarder in Tahlequah. He was a very, very quiet person. I researched the legal record exhaustively. And I knew what most of the players, most of through my dad's relationships in the county, in the area. So I was able to talk to judges, prosecutors. I talked to other people who knew Donnie. You know, he was a very quiet person. He was very private person. So I wrote this screenplay, went through Sundance workshops, went through Tribeca. Didn't really feel comfortable in feature and narrative filmmaking. Mm-hmm. I was Cade and Steve and Yazzie and I were thinking of we were you know, becoming becoming more interested in having, you know, starting to submit proposals to museums and starting to network with curators like Joe Baker, who had a big influence on our to help us start the collective. From there, we started doing residencies, started doing these interventions, mm-hmm. And I felt that I was just a better fit in the fine art world than I was in the filmmaking world. That being said, I still do them both. Mm-hmm. I work more as a technician today in filmmaking, and that's not to say that I won't I won't ever create another documentary again. But I, right now I primarily work as an editor and a sound recordist.
So what was one of the more important interventions, do you think, you guys did with Post-Commodity in the early days, I guess?
The most important piece, the work that really cemented Post-Commodity as a important in art was a piece called "Do You Remember When?" And it was at Arizona State University at the Ceramics Research Institute, which was a museum on campus at Arizona State University that no longer exists, actually. I mean, there is still the Ceramics Research Institute, but they knocked the building down. What we did was cut a hole in the floor to expose the ground underneath, worked with members of the Peeposh community, buried a speaker in the ground, recorded a Peeposh song, had that Peeposh song coming out of the ground, out of the dirt, to remind people of the original stewards of the land. The opportunity arose because there was a sustainability conference at Arizona State University, and we felt there was not an indigenous voice, or somebody felt that. We felt that, and then we were invited to create an intervention. So that was really, "Do You Remember When?" was the first mature work of Post-Commodity, in my opinion.
How about one of the more important projects that was toured, or interventions that was toured, that went out of the country?
"Do You Remember When?" We had another opportunity to do that I'm blanking on Australia's Biennale. It's Australia has a Biennale. This is the Sydney Biennale. It's the third oldest Biennale in the United States.
Right.
So the Museum of New South Wales, which is, I guess you could compare it to the Met in New York City, we had an opportunity to cut a hole in that floor. Whereas at Arizona State, they laughed at us, and then we went through the administrative slog and were able to do it. Once we did it once, then we were starting to be invited. Mm-hmm. I would say, some of the other more, you know, kind of important pieces that I worked on were more just verdant. I'm kind of blanking on the names, but also there's a piece called Gallup Motel Sheep Butchering that is a very very powerful work. But the entire body of work of Post-Commodity is very impressive, and it's hard to kind of choose one.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working with them, we were primarily working in Canada, and a lot of our major works were in Canada. One was, I'm blanking on the names of all these pieces, and it's been years and years.
Well, you did. I don't know if it was your first solo installation, but you did one in their space. And of course, they love plays on words, but in their space in Albuquerque, Spirit Abuse.
Uh-huh.
So you did, I read, a drone video altar. Was that your first?
Yeah, our space.
Was that your first solo, in, was it a solo installation, and was it your first installation?
I think so. I think that was probably some of my first, they're called drone videos. Spirit abuse is something that I brought to the collective, the concept, working in American Indian Health and Social Justice. Mm-hmm. I was on a reservation, and I saw on a poster, I saw, you know, there was elderly abuse, drug abuse, then I saw spirit abuse.
Wow.
And I asked somebody, I said, well, what is spirit abuse? And they said, well, it's when like a medicine man would, or somebody who would, you know, put themselves forth as a medicine man will take somebody into a sweat lodge and maybe take advantage of them sexually or use their, you know, manipulate people, you know, using spiritual things and stuff. So that's where that name came from, spirit abuse. And I lived in Albuquerque 2011, mm-hmm. for the year 2011. It didn't open until 2012, and I moved to Texas outside of Austin. But that was called Drone Videos, Drone Video Altar. Mm-hmm. And those videos are real. Drone is not a reference to the now ubiquitous flying small airplane or small planes with cameras. Drone is a type of music. That is related to minimalism, the classical strain of music, the most popular modern strain of classical music, minimalism. And so it's music that is very unchanging. It has a very slow attack and has a very slow release, or it's very repetitive, and that's droning. There are drones all around us all the time. There's a drone in this room right now. So I have been developing an interest in Lamont Young, Phil Niblock, and other minimalist composers, and Terry Riley. And in 2009, when one of our first post-commodity works first started to mature, really do our mature work, Raven Chacon, who was a composer, became a member of the collective. And so he had a very a big influence on my practice. We were both part of an underground, a noise underground. It's kind of an extension of punk and a do-it-yourself community. It was a very extreme music, a lot of dissonance and playing, you know, it's a very experimental and avant-garde, but it also has a very close connections to art music, such as Lamont Young, Tony Conrad, and Phil Niblock, and those guys. So Raven had been studying with those people at CalArts, and through this kind of web of underground people who work at high and low music, I ended up at Bard. Mm-hmm. That's how I ended up there, to study that. But those are my drawings, my drone videos. They're animations.
Okay.
That I do, and I do draw. I make sketches and things, but they're mostly just ideas for sculptures. But I consider that my drawing practice. And it's a way for me to also stay sharp animating. And so they're very subtle animations, oftentimes with colors that change. I'm interested in trance also, things like that. I'm kind of altered states, and that has to do with time, my interest in ceremony and ritual and things like that. And I'm not saying, I don't want it to sound like mystical, like, you know, like whatever, but it is a, like it or not, it is a part of a lot of non-Western traditions and even some Western traditions. So repetition, trance, slow moving things. That's where the drone videos came from. I still make them today.
Okay.
I fold them into records. They're kind of like, they become records, they become videos, they become visual art pieces. They're my drawing.
So yeah, it looked just from reading online like you released a lot of CDs with post-commodity, and I was wondering, are those then these kinds of musical experiments you've been talking about, this kind of?
Yeah, very much so. Those are noise and free improvised free and improvised musics. And that again, that tradition is also connected to, while it's connected to avant, you know, like Western classical avant-garde, it's connected to black radical movements of the 60s, Amiri Baraka, Albert Eiler, and John Coltrane's later work, which was called free jazz. There was a very successful underground record label here in Tulsa called Digitalis, and I developed a collaborative relationship and we with a guy named Brad Rose, and we released a close to 50 cassettes on different underground record labels around, or they released our music on about 50 cassettes. I had my own underground label, record label, and that's kind of where Raven, the connection with Raven came from. But that music is not far off. It's noise music. But my part in it, in most of that, sometimes I would use antlers, non-traditional instruments, till eventually on We Lost the Forest, that was my voice. Mm-hmm. That was primarily my instrument then.
So do you have, are they open access? Do you produce open access music, or what's your philosophy behind the music and then the CDs? How do they work?
Well, I license my music, say for mm-hmm. instance, the beginning of Sterling Harjo's film Miko, that's my music. Mm-hmm. I'll create music, or I'll license it to anyone. It's not a money-making endeavor. I do it now here in Tulsa, where there's not a space for that. Even Brad Rose and Digitalis, who I was in Agileska with, he's more well-known in Europe and in Australia, in New York City, and in L.A., where they had a festival for his label, than he is here in Oklahoma. Nobody knows who he is here whatsoever. But he's very well known in these other spaces. It's not a money-making deal. I've never been able to or tried to monetize it other than for film. And that's just purely a kind of a, the nature of it, the nature of the business. I don't focus on recording and releasing music. Mm-hmm. Primarily, I've been curating shows here, putting together music shows of experimental music, trying to create a space for that type of expression here. Mostly in Tulsa, in my opinion, it was this hardcore heavy metal town. And so the DIY spaces were dominated by that type of music, which they do let some experimental music be part of it. Mm-hmm. But the bars and things, they want to sell beer. Raven's very notable in Albuquerque, New Mexico, for making a space for avant-garde and creative, you know, outsider music there. I've been traveling for the past, you know, four, five years, performing at noise festivals, and now I'm curating a festival here in Tulsa of minimalism. It's called Tulsa Noise, Drone, and Sound Art. But I think we're bringing some major luminaries in for this first year, and have support from the Kaiser Foundation, the Kaiser Family Foundation. The Philbert Museum and the Bob Dylan Archive are also partners in this endeavor, and that'll be in the spring of this year. So by living here and knowing how difficult it was to find a way to, you know, to find that community,
right.
We've had to make that community here.
Right.
We've had to, you know, I've had to find collaborators that aren't necessarily even people living in Tulsa. They might be living in Tahlequah or Stillwell. I had to go to Detroit to meet other noise artists from Tulsa, but they were so young. There was no, you know, I just didn't know them, but
right.
I'm in Detroit and I see these guys with Tulsa shirts on and I'm like, what, you know, who are you? Yeah.
And I was just wondering if any of those pieces also had been created in conjunction with an intervention, but not necessarily, that's what you're saying.
The Drone Altar.
The music on the CDs, yeah, the post commodity.
Yeah, well, there was the very first album that has the antlers on it. I'm just blanking on the names of them. It was a part of this large scale intervention installation in the Ice House in Phoenix, Arizona, which was again one of our kind of earliest, you know, works. Mm-hmm. But it was more of an intervention. It was site specific. We played in the dark. It was when we were starting to use things like antlers and animal calls and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But that I'm just blanking on the names of the albums and titles.
We can add them later too. Well, you're working in collaboration with other artists, you know, requires a kind of different skill base, or it requires a specific skill base. So I'm wondering, as opposed to working solo, so what are some of the challenges of collaboration, and what are some of the rewards?
I still work collaboratively. I'm trying to, in my own individual practice, I'm trying to construct a very complex narrative and my own type of creative mythology. I'm trying to mythologize and reimagine this kind of world, you know, kind of these reflections, so others can kind of see this experience that I think was really unique and important. I think through the micro, you can see the macro, and I'm trying to express that. Working collaboratively is natural for me as a filmmaker, as my original training as an artist. One of the great things about working collaboratively and one of my experiences in post-commodity is that you can engage these very large scale projects that generally, unless you're Christo or somebody, you know, I'm not saying that they're not possible, but that, you know, we were able to engage, and that was the reason. Why do small projects? Why does it take five people to do a small project? You know, four people to, you know, create these very large scale interventions. Kind of the difficulties in working in a collective is that oftentimes you're competing for ideas. And the great thing about it is your ideas are competing. For dominant, it's going to look like something, and somebody's idea is going to have the most influence on it. I had always heard art by committee was the worst type of art, you know. I think that applied more to city councils and murals and things like that. To us, in my experience and my days in post-commodity, it was more of a bonus. The work became richer from the ideas. We were constantly critiquing each other's, input or suggestions and things. But that was an observation that somebody said to me, it must be really hard to have your ideas competing. And I never really thought about it until somebody, articulated it that way. That's one of the few drawbacks. The other is that you oftentimes have to, explain, that you're an artist in your own right if you don't have your own individual practice. Another part of working in what I found difficult in post-commodity was finding a balance between my own individual practice and giving giving time to my own individual practice, which I was not at a level where it was supporting me monetarily, so I still was working as a filmmaker, creating documentary films in health and social justice. So, I mean, that's the balance that everybody has to find. I think nobody's unique in that it's hard to make a living as an artist. I think today in 2017, we talk about these new models of making art, and collectives are one of the first things that people talk about. The problem is the collectives are personalities, things like that. We were all very, very close friends in post-commodity. That was part of the strength, and is, and I still think today is part of the strength of their work. Ultimately, you know, it's just like anything else. It's a mixed bag. It has its own struggles. When we were first beginning our practice as a collective, awards like the Adeljorg, or is it, what's it called now? Adeljorg, well, yeah. Creative, yeah. Yeah. Native Arts Culture Foundation, yes. they did not acknowledge collectives. You could not apply as a collective. And now it's become a standard or conventional practice. And it's great to see a collective. I'm still very interested in, like, YAMS, as I don't think is working anymore, but the Otolith collective. But I'm very proud of being a part of Post Commodity. I know that they're still making they're still influencing and kind of leading edge of you know, Indigenous people working in the contemporary art vernacular. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can
impress. Yeah, and you yourself have you're not a member anymore. Around 2015 is when you said you
I left the collective in 2015.
Well, can you talk a little bit about your website features a couple of installation pieces, and maybe just it was cool. It looked like the round house, which is undergoing another incarnation now. It was set on like a rooftop here in Tulsa to photograph it. Was that right above the AHA building? Or I was trying to figure out where it was.
Yeah. Well, the round house really comes from my work and at the last couple of years, and really what I wanted to focus on, and one reason why I was having a hard time finding a balance between my own individual practice and post-commodity is because I'm an Oklahoma Indian, and I have deep roots in this state, and I have a great affection for my community here, and I believe in service, and I wanted to be here. I wanted to be, you know, I'll go wherever opportunity takes me, but I want to be here. I want to be around Pawnees, Delawares, Shawnees, Kiowas. I want to be around Comanches. I want to be around, I want to talk about, you know, families. I want to talk about, you know, who married who, who's, you know, from where, you know, who's who folks are, things like that. The roundhouse is kind of represents this inner tribalism that I am trying to express an inner tribal experience, a very Oklahoma Indian experience. The roundhouse that I built is really from both sides of my, is inspired by both sides of my family. On my father's side, as a Delaware, the Delaware and Shawnee Peyote people, they were called prophets back then, oftentimes built these roundhouses to as shelter to create a space to practice the Native American church or Peyote religion. And so they're still built in use today, built and building them right now. But they're also influenced by my Pawnee my Pawnee heritage. There's a roundhouse in Wichita, Kansas, that has a recording of my great grandfather Henry Chapman telling a story, a Pawnee story. And so, what I was doing with that piece, with that roundhouse, which is going through a number of different iterations, mm-hmm. It's about to go through its third iteration right now. I performed with it. I just built it. I just wanted to build it. Uh-huh. I just wanted to make Indian architecture, you know, mm-hmm. And it's not Indian architecture. It's but it is my, you know, it's kind of an imagining that, right. Reimagining it. Mm-hmm. And so I tied ropes around it, put contact mics on it, shook it with specialized speakers. And as part of this music series that I curated through my first year here, I performed with it as a musical instrument. So really the first iteration of that roundhouse was as a musical instrument, and now I'm using it more purely as a visual art sculpture.
That's really interesting. So Knitting American Church is a theme of your work at different times too, and you have a piece that's on your website, and there's a cedar box or some other things associated with NACE, and there's also a
derringer,
pearl-handled derringer, and I wondered if you could talk about.
Yeah, that's a, that became like a very, very controversial piece which I totally understand and I'm fine with and was prepared for, you know. But it's really about a story. It's really a story that I was told about a young boy who really liked peyote meetings. And so he liked to have play peyote meetings in his backyard. So his uncles and his parents would set up a tent in the backyard, and they made him a little, they took a little toolbox, and they put a little gourd in there, a little thing, and he would do these play peyote meetings. And his uncle, a good friend of mine, walked into, you know, or went in there and was singing songs with them and playing, doing a play peyote meeting. And oftentimes in ceremonies, you're corrected. You might do something wrong just because you don't know. And his uncle said to this little boy, he said, "No, you're doing that wrong." And that little boy didn't like it. And so he reaches into his peyote box and he pulls out a cap gun and he points and he says, "Get out of here." And his uncle was telling me, he said, "Man, what kind of peyote man is that?" You know, but really what I'm doing with that piece is, one, I'm trying to tell that story. The other is thing is that I'm trying to engage the conventions of ethnology and anthropology and how work is represented and packaged or musealized, how it is used in museums. It's basically, I have a large collection of peyote boxes and Native American church fans that I've inherited. I don't make them. But I've inherited to my family. I take them to peyote meetings. I wanted to remake and problematize, and kind of, you know, really it's really kind of in a sense a critique on this type of conventions of anthropology and ethnology telling this story as well. I have another piece called the American Indian Cultural Center, American Indian Cultural Center and Museum 49. And it's basically inviting people to sing 49 songs, Plains Indian singers, powwow singers, to play, to use their hoods of the cars instead of a drum and sing 49 songs in front of that museum, which has been a problematic space. It's been kind of mothballed, and then now somebody's, Jim Pepper Henry's working on trying to open it. But it's been almost 20 years, a 20-year project, and this building is just the bones of the building. So I wrote an intervention for that. But again, what I'm doing is I'm trying to musealize these things that generally are not ever brought into museums. Low art and high art, these low and high. It's kind of, and so just like in post-commodity, we're trying to push the boundaries of what's possible in a museum, say like cutting the floor of it. I'm trying to push at the boundaries and make complex these kind of, you know, forms of representation. And that piece is, I'm not trying to give the impression that Native American church or peyote people carry guns in it, but I'm trying to tell a story, a cute story that I heard.
Right.
But it's art. It's going to be it's going to be received and translated in a number of different ways, and no matter what you do, and I don't know if that's the beginning or the ending of those types of work. those POD boxes. I have a number of drawings for other POD box pictures in that style. There's been a magazine also. The Gilcrease Museum did a magazine on POD boxes. So it's something that's been anthologized quite a bit. And so I have some, but other, but I don't know. I don't know if it's a beginning or an end, but I'll just kind of see where it takes me. Right. I do have suggestions from POD people on what to do.
I bet. So you've said that you've never sold a piece of art. That's not your orientation. And in market-oriented work, you know, knowing who produced the art is, of course, important. And the artists find various ways to inscribe their names on whatever it is. But I'm just curious about installations. Is there such a thing as signing an installation, or how does, or is it simply that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think there is a way. Uh-huh. I mean, because there's infinite possibilities with installations. You can create anything, so it's totally possible to sign an installation. I forgot. I just kind of lost my train of thought. As far as like, I think that you know, it's a possibility because you could do anything with an installation. So,
But you don't do that.
No, I don't. I mean, I make prints. I make prints. I make, you know,
what,
and I I'll sign them. But I'm not really making them. You know, they're a part of a larger context. I'm sure, you know, there's a concept of ambience that's very closely connected to installation art. You're trying to create an ambience. You're trying to create an atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And so, like in the post-commodity with Do You Remember When, you know, the museum walls are like the painting, you know? You could compare it to the painting. They become the painting themselves. So, I do put my name. I do incorporate my name into the work. I do incorporate family photos. Mm-hmm. I create photos, I recreate photos, and I use found photos. Mm-hmm. I create flags. I create things you could sell. However, I'm mostly, and this sounds might sound a little pretentious or whatever, but I just want to be free to do whatever I want to do, you know, and that's really my main concern is to have unencumbered freedom of expression, mm-hmm. you know, that's really my goal and my work and something that, and that means pushing the boundaries of things, but that comes from my upraising or my in Tahlequah and watching Indian gaming happen. And, you know, growing up around people that were the descendants of outlaws like Starr and Barkers and the, you know, Ned Christie, descendants of those people. There's a spirit there where I'm from. We cherish our freedom, you know, and that's what I try to reflect that in my artwork. I know sometimes the things that I do and that we've done in post-commodity have been risky, say with some of my work in the New American Church and the, say, Gallup Motel sheep butchering. I'm not trying to represent myself as a POD man. I'm more of an art historian and an artist working and engaging one subject, which I think really represents intertribalism in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I'd like to sell work.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I think it requires a definite skill set to be able to continue that creative freedom, because then, you know, your focus rather than on selling is basically on sort of putting in proposals, right? Answering calls for proposals. What kinds of skills do you need?
Yeah, well, I lost my train of thought, and that takes me back to it, actually. is, and that's really what we learned in post-commodity was that in installation art, really, while your audience may only be for an intervention, which is a general term for those type of work, especially as political work and, you know, kind of multicultural identity type of stuff that we do, or that I did with them. We learned the importance of documentation, and there's a second life to installation art, and that's very important. And probably as important or more important is the artist statement. Mm-hmm. So if you look at post-commodities website, there's a lot of the artist statements are usually very complex, articulating very complex ideas. So writing is probably the most important skill set that you need as an artist that's not working, that if you're not market-based. Writing is probably the most important skill set you have. Even as a tribal council person, my tribe is not traditional in the sense that our main form of communication is through our Delaware Indian news. And so my ability to communicate and speak to each individual Delaware depends on my ability to articulate what I think is important to them, to keep them up to date on what we're doing, to explain what we're doing, to be transparent. And in art making, it's the same thing. That sharpens my ability to do that. I know that my work, my time in post-commodity, my time writing grants for proposals for documentaries and health and social justice, writing the Tulsa Artist Fellowship grant, they sharpened my ability to be able to communicate to Delaware Indians, to let them know what my concerns are for our tribe and our community, and what I want to work on, what I think is important for us. It's just the same thing. So I think writing, I have an interest in poetry. I'm not a poet. Again, members of the collective are. I'm more interested in the poetics of space. I'm interested in the etymology of poetry as how things work. I'm interested in how things work. But I attended a visiting artist at a poetics workshop this summer in New Mexico. I did a sound performance. But I do engage text in my work. I have a piece called We Are Making a New World, which is about my experience back east, where my Delaware tribe comes from. And I used a found poem using our language archive. I constructed a found poem trying to move through time and space and explain what our experience was like. We didn't have a trail of tears. We went through 9 states. We never stayed in one place more than 30 years. So if you think about that, some people never got to die where they were born. Most people did experience a removal. We were constantly immigrating, forced to immigrate from spot to spot. And so I was able to, and that's the reason why I move across a lot of different media, or mediums and materials, because in that case, that was the best way for me to tell that story. I wanted people in upstate New York to understand that these were the northernmost edges of our territory, where we turned in from Unami speakers into Muncie speakers. It was the northernmost edge of my people into the mountain people. And I wanted to explain to them that, you know, this is our homeland. And the best way to do that was through using our language archive and created a found poem and a multi-channel sound installation.
Yeah, that sounds really neat. And you just made a trip, right, about a week ago. Where did you go as part of the fellowship, I guess? Did you go give a lecture or?
No.
Oh, you were traveling for research or?
No, I was just giving a lecture about my work at at a University of Missouri, Columbia. And it was just about my practice in general. It was a Native American Awareness Month there, and I was just invited to give a lecture there. I'm about to travel in 2 weeks to Omaha, Nebraska, to the Bemis Center to do a sound installation there. And I'll engage my Pawnee experience and a family archive that my Chapman family has amassed to create a sound piece and to bring Pawnee voices and Pawnee talk about our experience there and remind people that while Omaha wasn't necessarily the capital or wasn't exactly where we lived, we were from Nebraska, and I want to engage that experience in that space in a art show called Monarch, curated by Risa Puello at the Bemis Center.
Oh, that sounds really great. So what kinds of, what's your creative process from the time you get an idea?
It's really hard for me to kind of articulate my creative process because I feel like I'm working all the time. If I'm listening to an album, it could lead to me doing something.
Are you writing things down when you get?
I mostly create drawings for ideas. I'll have an idea, and mostly I'll do a very unskilled, a really sloppy drawing of something. A lot of times, people inspire me. Most of the time, the latest iterations of this roundhouse that I've been working with mm-hmm. are inspired by stories that I've heard. Going to POD meetings. I'm inspired by my family history and my own experience. I look at things like infrastructure. You know, my experience watching my father, my grandfathers help reorganize the Delaware tribe and the Pawnee tribe and the Cherokees. They were providing services. We were using, you know, their and today we're building infrastructure. We're trying to serve people. And so that's my experience. And so I like to use things like cement. I like to use things like, pipe. Pipes. I'm obsessed with public address systems. I'm obsessed with tornado sirens. So I'm constantly looking around at tornado sirens, the infrastructure around us, how electrical grids work, how workers are able to navigate electrical grids are an influence on my work that is kind of cryptic, but I use it in printmaking and I use it to compose. So I'm just really inspired all the time. I'm kind of a maximalist. I love the language of minimalism, but I'm fascinated. I'm just a lifelong learner. I'm enthusiastic. I feel like I'm a happy person. I feel like things that bring me joy are things that I want to express through my art. The energy they create, the energy for me to make the piece. I feel an impetus. Mm-hmm. You know, I might my music might sound dirgy, like a dirge, and dissonant and ugly and sad and things, but generally, I'm wanting to celebrate in a sense, I'm trying to be didactic, but I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to be goofy, and say that this is all so beautiful. I mean, even the problems and the problematics of it, there's something to be gleaned good from it. And so I'm just inspired by my community. And I can't really, and that's really what a lot of my work's about too, is a lot of my work is about not being able to express something, that ability, that kind of, it's hard to say, it's hard to explain, and again, that goes back to poetics, looking back at native languages, installation art, learning from Edgar, learning how, like say Pawnee, how they dealt with the car, how the Cherokees deal with how to say computer. You know, those types of things are my inspiration. And how do they go through this weird process to where it becomes sublimated, just like in post-commodity, these ideas become sublimated, they would come out some other way. So I really don't have a natural process that I can follow. I wish I did, because I would try to monetize it.
And this is your second year of the fellowship, right?
This is my second year of the Tulsa Arts Fellowship.
So how has the experience changed for you?
Well, I lived in Tulsa before the fellowship, before I had even heard of the fellowship. And I heard of the fellowship through the Cherokee Phoenix, actually. When I first moved here, my wife at the time and I had a boutique, and we had a performance space and improvised or provisional gallery there. I was friends with the filmmaking community here, but really nobody knew me. And I was friends with an experimental, you know, a collaborator, and Brad Rose and Digitalis at Gillesco doing these cassettes. And I worked with Sterling Harjo and doing filmmaking. So I knew those guys, two different worlds. I moved back here, and there was really not a space for this type of work even. It was very much people. I'm not trying to be unkind or anything, but when people thought of art, they only thought of painting and sculpture. And so today, even today, I have a little bit of difficulty expressing my practice to people who want to make it very simple, whether my medium is wood or my medium is ceramics or something like that. I just tell them I'm trying to tell a very complex story, and I'm working, you know, people in contemporary art in this vernacular have worked very hard, you know, to open up art, to make it plural, and to make it to where you can, you know, art can be many different things. It can be, you know, your intervention in a museum or something like that. But I've really seen the town change. I've really seen the sheer number of people, the artists that they brought in, even the first year. It seemed like the first 6 months, everybody was trying to get their footing and trying to figure out what was going on, where they were. And at that 6 months, it felt like there was a tipping point, and everybody started to figure out how they could work here, how they could maneuver here, you know, because a lot of them came from major art centers. I was one of the few, or in my class, I was the only Oklahoman that got it. Oh, well, Chris Ramsey got it as a fellow, but I was the only Tulsan. I've seen a huge change in the city, not only just the buildings and things, but I've seen how people's practices, the diversity of practices of the fellowship have had an influence on people here. I've been able to teach a sound art workshop at the University of Tulsa. Now I teach sculpture at the University of Tulsa. I'm just adjunct, but I teach their sculpture class. But I'm able to expose them to my students, to artists who I think otherwise they might not have been able to engage their practices. I know that just the networks of the other artists, it's like a very large web, you know, that extends out to Kansas City, Dallas, Houston, all the way to Los Angeles, around the world. And so I've seen it make a difference in the city. I've seen it transform the city physically, but I've also noticed the change in the conversation. I feel like the conversation has become much more sophisticated or cosmopolitan, in a sense that it's not about whether this is art or is this not art. People are much more, it's changed. It's changed the community. I can attest to that. I've seen it. It's just my opinion, but I've seen it.
So what has been one of the high points in your career so far?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have any kind of high points. I am really proud of my experience. I decided to go in 2014 to Bard College, or 2013. I started to attend Bard College, And nothing had more of an influence on my art practice than Bard College, post commodity, than Bard. And I feel very fortunate to have been able to attend that school, and it was like it just changed my life. You know, I mean, I've been very fortunate to be around great Indians, great Native Americans and Indians, and been around great amazing peers. I'm just in the right place at the right time most of the time. But Bard is something that was really a kind of a high point for me, because I would just walk in to critiques or walk into people's studios and be intimidated and inspired. And it felt like it was something like doing art push-ups. It gave me a new vernacular. It taught me how to read and to understand art better than I had already been trained to do. It changed my life. It changed my understanding of what I could do in art, and exposed me to a network otherwise that I don't think I could have accessed. And you know, I'm paying for it through student loans, but I don't regret it one bit. But I do miss that community here. That's one of the downsides of being so far away from there, is I miss the conversation. I miss seeing the development of the work of all of those people. They're spread out. Some people are in LA, some are in New York, some are Chicago, Milwaukee, other places. But I loved working in post-commodity, and I loved my time at Bard College. And so those are really, rather than one type of installation, one art piece or anything like that, I would say that those two experiences have just been, you know, high points in my art career.
How about a low point?
A low point? Well, I think, you know, the low point is just being immature. And there's really, when you're young, you expect everything to happen immediately. You feel entitled. When I was writing screenplays like Heavy Metal Indians, I wondered why, you know, I wasn't getting the chance to make a feature film. I don't think, looking back now, I was mature enough to make that feature film. Things are different today. The filmmakers that I still work with today are getting those shots. But it took us 10 years, you know, watching, you know, working under others. And now when I look back, you know, there's so much emphasis placed on these kind of Wunderkinds, you know, these kind of young, you know, stars, and there's so much emphasis and, you know, placed on, you know, being youth, the youth market and things like that. And so I felt, you know, I think that's something that a lot of young people relate to, is that they think that, you know, they're not getting their chance, but it's just really not their turn yet. And so, I don't think I've had a low point. I think that I probably just expected too much too quick when I was a young man, and that's something I've just been kind of realizing as an adult, or as I've gotten older and aged. But I feel I know that I'm fortunate and really blessed to be able to do kind of this kind of work, and I have worked hard to get here, but I think that anybody that is as fortunate as me, I can't call it a low point, because me personally, I try to use it as a learning experience. I mean, I might not have felt like that at the time, but today I try to look back and try to take a lesson from those times when the phone wasn't ringing, whenever I was, you know, when my bank account was, you know, had a lot of, you know, was in the red or something like that. So, but I, no low points really, just being immature and just being a punk.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll pause for a minute and then we'll look at a couple of examples of your work.
Okay.
Okay, Nathan.
So what I'm standing in front of here is a an example of me using photography and my own family archive or my own family photography in my artwork. Like I said earlier, I'm trying to construct a really a complex narrative, a very, very long mythology, but I'm trying to reimagine things. And this was part of an installation called Infinite Peyote Road. And I always like to give a disclaimer about, you know, my work at the Native American Church. It's not about me. I mean, it is about my experiences, but I'm not trying to represent myself as any type of expert peyote man or anything like that. I'm a member of a chapter, and I go to meetings, but I've always been fascinated by the work. I've always been obsessed with the peyote paintings in my parents' house. I've always known who peyote people were, and then eventually started to go back. But this is me receiving my name during a peyote ceremony from the last Delaware language name giver and speaker, Nora Dean Thompson. Mm-hmm. And I've altered the photo quite a bit. The idea of that installation was really to kind of think about the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, the whole idea that the Native American Church, the legal battles that they've gone through, and the church has gone through, and the importance that it is, how important it is for all Americans and for all origins, all religions, as the vanguard for the freedom of religion. If it wasn't for the Native American Church, we would be repressing religions. And so at one time it was an outlawed religion. And that's one reason why something I try to do is, since I come from, not try to do, was something that was kind of natural, was this kind of using the vernacular of rock and roll or underground music or punk rock music. And there was a design firm called Hypnosis that made these album covers that was famous for, you know, co-opting these bars to hide the eyes of the innocent or the guilty. And so this is me getting my name, my Delaware name, in a peyote meeting. And it was actually also documented in a journal of anthropology about Delaware naming ceremonies. And so it's my understanding that I was one of the last people, my brother and I were some of the last people to receive names from Nora Dean Thompson. It looks like a little gun in my hand there. That was at a peyote meeting, and just kind of, those are some of my earliest recollections. And it's my experience. I don't want, you know, I'm just trying to assert myself in it, because it's based around my experience, you know, it's based around my experience. But my thing is, I'm engaging the archive. You know, it already exists in this anthropological journal. And so I'm really just mixing it up. I'm trying to, I could do another iteration of it with that article or whatever. But yeah, that's probably all I have to say on that.
Okay, we're ready.
So this what we're looking at here is a homemade flag. Again, from I put all of these kind of different pieces together to create this, out of this large body of work about the Native American Church I've been creating, in this installation called Infinite Peyote Road. But what I'm doing here is I'm trying to imagine or reimagine logos of the Native American Church, part of the problematics of the Native American Church, or not problematics, but if you're carrying peyote with you, and again, I'm trying to tell the story of the Native American church. I want people to understand the beauty of the religion. I'm not trying to be pious and say that I'm some kind of great peyote person, but I want people to know how important this religion is in my community. And what I'm trying to do is to reimagine these logos. What she would do is, if you were driving down to what are called the peyote gardens, there are all types of bureaucracies and paperwork you need to carry large amounts or any amount of peyote with you. And so people would have these cards. We have chapters. A chapter is like a church. And so I'm trying to reimagine or create these imaginary chapter symbols. And so this is kind of a crude, based on a peyote jewelry design off a German silver design, which is a very popular form of expression and art, or form of the Native American church and just in general Indian art in the 70s. I took a silver peyote pin that I have and tried to cut out, or you know, to reimagine it for a flag. What I'm trying to do though with this work is to make these images knowable through repetition. So while I don't expect the layperson to come in, of course nowadays there's always a didactic panel, but I want people to learn through repetition what these images are. That's kind of how I'm working. That's kind of what my practice, that's how I'm trying to communicate with people, is it's through repetition. And so around the bulbs of that look like petals, or they're really more bulbs of the peyote, these moons, which are these altars that are the part of the, there's two strains of the Native American church. There's half moon and then there's big moon. And I'm more familiar with the half moon ceremony that came from Quanah Parker. And so this is just an imaginary flag. I don't know, I've never heard of anybody creating a flag for Native American church, but I have seen cards with logos on it. I have, again, it's probably just my interest in looking at tribal seals, thinking about where tribes come from today. It's about the Native American church, but it's, you know, Indian in general. Really, ultimately, I was thinking about Brummett Echo Hawk and my grandpa Tom Chapman and the Pawnee tribe creating their flag, and the lady who created the first Pawnee flag. And so my mom, who is a Pawnee Kiowa woman, she makes Plains Indian dance or regalia. And so my mother and I collaborated on that. I cut out all the pieces and she sewed them on, just like she sews a shawl. So while she doesn't get credit, that's just a privilege that I get because it's my mother. But she's made outfits for other Indian Native American performance artists and things. And I thought, well, everybody else is collaborating with my mom, so I should start collaborating with my mom. But so this is my first kind of reimagined Native American church flag. But it's just imaginary. It's not anything I've seen anybody do. Yeah. I've never heard of it, but I just have an interest in flags, and somebody said it reminded them of the flags from Akira Kurosawa films, and so I just like the scale, I like what, you know, kind of the deeper symbols and meaning of community and kind of organization and representation and things like that. So.
Nathan, you're going to talk about your panels.
Yeah, so these are plaster panels. They are a motif that is very common in the church, in Native American church art. It is, so if you look at the work of Stephen Mopope or Achai, they would have these moons in their prints and paintings as kind of a central figure sometimes. And there's a famous mural that Stephen Mopope painted in Anadarko that were of a moon with feathers on top of it. So what I'm trying to do is, I grew up at a time when that art was ubiquitous, or it seemed ubiquitous to me. And I feel like rather than only now the devotional art of the Native American church, the fans, the boxes, those things, they're very much being made and used today, and you know, people are making beautiful work. But I felt that that this type of experience was missing, or was very rare. But the inspiration is the Kiowa Five. Blue, yellow, and red are the colors of the robes of roadmen, the men who lead the ceremonies of Native American church meetings. And the Native American church is it's probably I saw a quote from Nora Dean Thompson that said that who was a Peyote person, said that she believed they were the most sincere prayers she's ever heard. And really what I'm trying to do is kind of pay tribute in a way, in this really abstract way, to these men, people who kind of keeping this tradition alive. You know, the Native American church came from a time of great spiritual crisis when we were losing our original indigenous religions. And the Native American church was this vessel where we could keep very important parts, or we could kind of hide parts of individual religions in it. But in my experience, Peyote people are very, very humble. And that's when I go back to that, the sincerity. It's a very, very humble religion. And oftentimes the men the people who are the primary or the compose the community are, you know, in my experience, work at our housing authorities. They build homes. They're craftsmen. They're mechanics. I've even heard people use the word mechanics talking about Native American church things. But what I'm trying to do is use repetition. I'm also thinking about the history of contemporary art. These very simple color, you know, minimalism, things like that, in a very crude way. But really, in a way, I'm really, you know, these things in real life, real altars. These are, you know, I call these altars, but they're not. They're ethereal. They're dirt, and they go away. And you'd never know they were there. What I'm doing is I'm thinking about the people, you know, who make them, who make those altars, and thinking about the Kiowa Five and those motifs, and just trying to put my own take on it and make something that I think's interesting. I don't necessarily think this. I don't know who this works for. You know, I'm not trying to make this for Native American church people to come and to give me any kind of accolades for or anything. I'm trying to reflect my experience as an Oklahoma Indian, as an intertribal person who grew up around these people and do this practice. And to me, these are just, I just think of them and these guys and who I know run these meetings, and it is very gendered. There are road men, but they build homes. They're home builders, and they're men. They're people that work with their hands and stuff. And so this was just something natural that I've done them in concrete. drywall. But, you know, it also is kind of an influence that of Bard, where people were, you know, doing paintings or drawings on walls and then cutting the piece of the wall out with them. So I'm just kind of mixing all kinds of artistic languages or vernaculars together to try to express my experience as an Oklahoma Indian.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Nathan.
You're welcome. Thank you.